Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Hi, this is Mike Thurway, stylistic provocateur and proud Silmarillionaire. Welcome to Silmarillion Seminar number 15, covering Silmarillion chapter 14 of Beleriand and its realms. Listeners, get your compasses ready. This week's episode we've titled On Ash and Slag. We discuss the geographical survey of Beleriand, the barrage of names, why folks bail out on the Silmarillion when reading this chapter, and why readers should press on. Why Angband is not on the map of Beleriand, the fallibility of the Valar, all those door names, the patterns of Elvish language revealed in the place names, how many elves live in Beleriand, the dynamic protagonists of Beleriand, Sirion and Gellion. We circle back to the loophole-free Oath of Feanor. We recall Treebeard's In the Willowmead song and Tolkien's love of the land described in this chapter. And we close with a discussion on filth and desolation. We discuss the ash and slag theme noted in this chapter and expanded on in The Return of the King. Did you know that an entry-level coal power plant worker is called an ash and slag man? Neither did I. Enjoy!
All right. So I trust everybody is excited here to get to what is no doubt everybody's favorite chapter. I think really that's more or less universal, widespread affection that people have for chapter 14 of the Quintus Silmarillion. I think actually Laura, your comment actually, the question that you posted is the one I would want to start with, because that's exactly the first thing. I mean, I think we need to get that right out on the table at the very beginning of this discussion here.
Sure. Yeah, I was reading this chapter, and what springs to my mind is Leviticus, where everybody stops in the Old Testament and kind of gives up. This chapter just seems so dry. You know, it's just talking about geography, and you know, I just wonder if this is where everybody quits and gives up and says no more. And it makes me wonder why Christopher Tolkien actually even put it in there. It almost seems more like notes for Tolkien himself to use to keep things straight.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly true. First of all, I think it is unquestionably true that everybody who makes it past the Valaquenta and gets past the chapter with the sundering of the elves, the one that we talked about at the beginning, of the princes of the Noldor. Everyone who makes it past that, I mean, of all the people who make it past there, I think a really big percentage lose it here. This is a chapter which I have often heard people allude to explicitly as the place where they lost it. And certainly, even if it's just, apart from the dryness of the subject, that is, as you say, it's like a geographical survey of Beleriand. Apart from that is, of course, the sheer volume of the names. I mean, people always have a problem with the names in the Silmarillion, and it's this continual barrage. Indeed, even in our discussion tonight, I feel pretty sure that I'm going to be more halting and fumbling than usual, because I'm not going to want to mess up names, and I'm sure I'm going to have to be looking up a bunch of things here and there, because I still get, the seven tributaries of Gellion mixed up and stuff like that. It's pretty bewildering. One of the things that I want to do over the course of our conversation tonight is not only begin to see some of the things that we can get from this and to think about what the function of this chapter is, but also I would like to start off just by sort of reissuing the general sort of caution or advice that I gave at the very beginning of the Silmarillion. That is, my number one piece of advice for new readers of the Silmarillion is don't try to memorize everything. Don't try to keep track of everything. With this, at least, you can keep kind of flipping back and forth with the map, both the map in the middle of the chapter in the Houghton Mifflin Trade paperback edition and the map in the front of the book, so that you can at least be kind of following as the narrator's voice moves up and down the continent in going through things. But still, I mean, that doesn't make it trivial. And, Laura, the point that you make about basically the decision that Christopher Tolkien made as editor in putting this in, I think on the one hand, I think you're right. I think that if there's going to be a single editorial choice that I would question, I mean, I think it would be this. There's very little in this chapter that I think, you know, we're not going to be able to live with if we don't know. That is, I don't think that the majority of readers of the Silmarillion really need this chapter. And I think it is an obstacle for people.
Yeah, it doesn't really move the story forward any. It just is almost like a brain dump of all these place names. And it's just kind of hard to slog through. I was listening to it in the car and just thinking, boy, I'm just getting lost, because I didn't have the map to look at especially. I think it helps a lot to be looking at the map when you're reading this.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I would say this is also definitely the chapter in the book which is least good for audio listening. The Martin Shaw does a pretty good job with it, but anyway, it's challenging. Unless you're really used to the names already, it can be really hard to follow. The one thing that I would say in defense that I would give for the editorial decision to include it is, you know, this is really, I mean, Tolkien loved this stuff. You know, it's not just sort of notes for his own benefit. Remember the comment that Tolkien makes in the prologue, or the preface rather, to the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, when Tolkien says, it's the famous preface where he talks about applicability versus allegory and all that stuff. But he also talks about the Silmarillion material, when saying that he had spent time working on the early history of Middle-earth, the First Age material, in other words, the Silmarillion stuff, but he had been told to give up, you know, when the people whose opinions he sought, changed his, he had said that I had little hope that anyone else would be interested in this, and then when the people whose input he sought, changed little hope to no hope, he gave it up and returned to the sequel of The Hobbit, and this is his explanation for how he came to write The Lord of the Rings. So in other words, remember, he had given up on the fact that anyone else was going to be interested in this. So, you know, like, what is notes and what is real narrative? I mean, he was writing this for his own benefit, and he clearly loved this stuff. And he spent a lot of time writing stuff out like this, but drawing maps of different kinds. You know, it's one of the really neat things to see in the History of Middle-earth series, sort of the evolution of his maps and the way that he was kind of thinking things out. He clearly, you know, this chapter in some ways, although it's not the most scintillating chapter in the book, this is also a very Tolkien chapter. I mean, this is the way that he thought. This is the stuff that he liked. Lots and lots of names and his experimentation and exploration of all of these, you know, places and the connections with their names and explanations for how names came to be and all of this stuff. If most readers don't like this, Tolkien loved it. So, I can certainly see why Christopher Tolkien did make the decision to include it, because I think his dad would have wanted it included. Now, that still doesn't make your observation perfectly valid, that the book perhaps might be more readable without it. But anyway, there it is. There were a few pronunciation questions and things that people had that I think we should get started with. Certain, goodness knows there are enough names in here we want to make sure that we're clear on things. One of you, Matt, I think you brought up the word which looks like region. And I've joked before about how Tolkien tends to give names to places that are really quite simple, when you translate it, it translates to something really quite obvious and straightforward. But it's not quite so bad as that, you know, that he's just going to call, like, I think I should call this region? Region. It's not region, it's Region. It is a hard G. Readers of The Lord of the Rings may remember that, you know, the area south of Rivendell, before the in the Ringo South chapter, before the Fellowship of the Ring crosses the Misty Mountains. They are in the land that was called Eregion, E-R-E, just like Regian with an E in front of it. This is the area of Regian, and the kingdom of Eregion was built afterwards and named for it in part. That's certainly, I think, the most common mistake of all of these names. Elizabeth, you were asking about Tarns and Tors. I love the fact that he uses those two words in one sentence. Yes, a tarn is a lake, and a tor is a very tall hill. A tor is usually like an isolated hill with very steep sides. And so the tors on Dorthonion, he says, are higher than, you know, the mountains across the way, because Dorthonion is this highland that slants up and up and up until it falls down in cliffs and mountains on the far side, in what is called Ered Gorgoroth, the Mountains of Terror. So yes, there are all these tarns and tors. Those are wonderful old words, old Anglo-Saxon words. So yes, that's what tarns and tors are. Let's see, Mike, I think you had a couple of definitions you were looking for also.
Hi, yeah, I just had a question about defining leaguer, L-E-A-G-U-E-R, and also how far is a league, and also where is Angband on the map?
Okay, yes, good. The leaguer, it means the siege, they're surrounding and hemming in Morgoth and his troops. So they have him in leaguer, which basically means they are besieging him. They have him surrounded and hemmed in. So he is soon, still not for a couple chapters, but he will soon, when is it? 17? Chapter 17 finally? No, 18? Yes, 18. That the leaguer is going to be broken, and he's going to break out of it. So that's what leaguer means. A league is usually 3 miles. I'm actually not positive what measure he's using here. Tolkien, in his usual systematic way, had established a whole system of weights and measures. Certainly within the Hobbit framework, but also the Numenorean framework, and usually a league is 3 miles. So I'm gonna kind of go with that. And I can't think right off the top of my head of a place where he defines that differently. But normally that's the definition of it. And what was your next question after that, Mike? There was leaguered. Oh, Angband. Where is Angband? Just north. I think it is actually really fascinating that Angband doesn't appear on almost any of the maps. I mean, if you look at the maps at the end of the book, if you look at the map in the middle of this chapter, if you look at the map at the beginning, Angband almost never appears in maps of Beleriand. And, I think that that's actually very cool. I think that that's, I'm not sure I would say that that's like necessarily a deliberate choice. I mean, on the one hand, it's not exactly in Beleriand, because Beleriand, in fact, you'll notice in this chapter at one point, it makes a distinction between Hithlum and Nevrast and Beleriand, that Beleriand is not just the name that's used like for the continent as a whole. Beleriand itself really only starts south of the mountains. So if you look at that map in the middle of the chapter, you've got the line of mountains that form the southern border of Nevrast and Hithlum, and then you've got the Pass of Sirion with Minas Tirith in the middle of it, where Orodreth is ruling, and then you've got Dorthonion in the mountains there, and over to Himlad, where Maedhros and Maglor are, over to the Blue Mountains. So from there you've got south of there, basically south of that roughly east-west line of mountains, is this stretch of land which is really Beleriand proper, divided into West Beleriand and East Beleriand by the River Sirion. So technically, Angband is actually pretty far away from Beleriand itself. But again, I think that there's a, I mean, I'm not sure it's not a kind of deliberate exclusion. you know, we're not interested in Angband. We're interested in this is the land of the elves. And I think there's a kind of a fun angle on the exclusion. He's right above Ardgallan. You know, you've got Dorthonion, the plain of Ardgallan right above it, and we're told that he just goes right up to the gates of Angband. And so it's up there. Everybody knows where it is, but we're not focused on it. It's not on the map. So I think that's actually kind of cool, though it does sometimes it does seem to sort of confuse people, I think. Let's go now on to sort of some more some larger questions that people have raised. Let's see, Chris, you wanted to talk about the Valar and Angband?
Well, I guess I don't know that I really don't have much to say about it, but it just seems like one of those things that the Valar don't seem to be good at tying up loose ends sometimes, and I think that's another one where they rushed over it in order to attack Autumno. Well, on the way home, they probably should have taken care of Angband a little bit more thoroughly, but that's just occurred to me this time when I read it and just thought I'd toss it out.
Yeah, no, it's true. Because we are told that it was in their haste. And, you know, in part, I think that we can...
Haste,
yeah,
to get there.
Yeah, I mean, he does seem to imply when he mentions that way back that this was just basically a kind of a sloppy job by the Valar. And I think in part you can see there that this was not the primary focus. I mean, remember when they came and they fought Morgoth the first time, subduing Morgoth was just a means to an end. The end was to secure the continent for the elves and to bring the elves and to clear a safe path for the elves to come over to Valinor. And that is the complete defeat of Morgoth and permanent expunging of his evil wasn't their goal. Like that wasn't what they set out to do, and they didn't do it. Now they did achieve the goal that they had, which was to subdue Middle Earth so that the elves would be safe at first, and safe to come over to Valinor. But they didn't set out to expunge evil, and they didn't succeed in expunging evil. And it does now. And another thing, though, that I would say, it's not that they just like completely overlooked it or anything. They didn't completely destroy it, and therefore Morgoth is able to kind of wump it up again pretty quickly when he gets back over there. Remember the reference in the last chapter when Feanor is doing his solo attack on Angband right before his death, and the narrator says he knew nothing of the defense that Morgoth had been able to build in so short a time. Now of course he had some stuff to work with, but he has been active since he's been back. And you know, the thing that I think, the parallel that I think that we can see that's interesting to think about here with Angband is Barad-dûr. You know, I think of the reference to the first destruction of Barad-dûr that is in the War of the Last Alliance, about how the Dark Tower was thrown down but its foundations remained, and then Sauron rebuilds it, of course. The Black Tower has been rebuilt. And I think that we can see a similar kind of thing here. There was a victory the first time, but it wasn't a permanent victory. This is a trend that we see. The failure of the Last Alliance ultimately to solve the problem is kind of in good company. You know, I mean, that's
a good parallel. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I hadn't either until a couple minutes ago, but it's really compelling once you start thinking about it.
Very good.
I think that we can see that, though in part, one of the things that I think emerges when you think about that parallel more, though, is that, you know, it's not, I mean, we were saying that it was sort of, you know, shoddy work on the part of the Valar, and yeah, it was from a certain perspective, just as, the victory of the Last Alliance was only a short-term gain, it was only a vain victory. Though remember that Elrond sort of speaks disparagingly of the victory of the last alliance, and then later on corrects himself. That it was not wholly fruitless. But anyway, so I think that
he had the complication of the Ring of Power without physically taking it from Isildur. They couldn't destroy the foundations and stuff like that. I'm nitpicking. I like picking on the Valar because at some places they show short-sightedness and not always very impressive. But hey, that's just me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is, it's an important thing to keep in mind, you know, that the Valar, Tolkien was very clear.
Infallible.
Exactly. Not infallible at all. They're not infallible and they're not omniscient. They're not omnipotent, of course, as we can plainly see. And we have all these reminders. They're not omniscient and they are not infallible. And, you know, this is one of the ways in which Tolkien makes it clear. By now, you know, how many chapters has it been since there's been any reference to Iluvatar? I mean, he's not a very queer presence already at this point. He's not been brought up very often lately. But there's these continual reminders like that this is not the whole show, you know, that the Valar are not the highest authority here. And just in case we have any questions about it, we can see how they kind of keep screwing up. So though again, I don't want to just dismiss it as screwing up either. Good comes of it. I mean, this is part of the story. The kind of failure of the Last Alliance, of course, is what sets up. Had Isildur just thrown the ring into the fire then what happened later, you know, wouldn't happen. And now, you know, this is part of the story, and this is what's, you know, now an opportunity for the later story is created, or, you know, is enabled by this. And therefore, you know, was it wrong? Was it bad that Isildur didn't throw it in the fire? Yeah, it was wrong that he didn't throw it in the fire. But in the end, greater glory comes of it, you know, all the way back to the Ainur Indale and what Iluvatar said would happen when people made bad choices and did bad things. So did the Valar screw up in not taking their opportunity to hunt down all the Balrogs and Sauron and everybody and make a clean wash of it? Yes. Yes, they messed up in doing that. Did they mess up in letting Melkor go? Yes, they messed up in letting Melkor go. But yet, although those were mistakes, great glory is going to come of it. And these stories which will be hard bought, but well bought. Nevertheless, evil will be good to have been. So I think we can still see it as part of the big picture. But it's
And if they had been more thorough, we wouldn't be
exactly.
Here
I mean, that's the thing. Now, is that to say that means that it's best? You know, no. I mean, of course, if everything had been blissful and peaceful the whole time, that would be better, right? But no, exactly. These stories have emerged because of those things. And again, I think that's what we can see that as part of this pattern of greater glory and bliss being brought out of the suffering caused by people's bad choices. So, okay, good. Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely fair. Let's see. John, I think you had a question about, you had a word question also about the elven element door, I think. I'll try to answer your question as I have it. The word door does mean kingdom, or land, really. Not necessarily kingdom in the sense of like belonging to a particular ruler, but land. It's a fairly general word. Remember that this is, I brought this up a couple weeks ago. You can see it, for instance, in Gondor, the land of stone. So here we can see it as well. All of those door names all mean land of something or other. Even Doriath, which is, most of them are hyphenated or two separate words. But Doriath, even though it's written as one word, is the same thing. Doriath, it means the land of the fence, referring to the girdle of Melian. I would say, you know, and in general, this is one of the things that I would point to as one of the big benefits of this chapter. So here we go. I'm gonna try my sales pitch here, my sales pitch for this chapter. Here's one of the things that I think that we can get from this chapter that's really valuable, and that is, if you're interested in the names, if you're interested in the language, do you want a little you know, layman's introduction to Sindarin? Well, here you go. And some Quenya too, but mostly Sindarin. Look at the names in these chapters, and you get so many of them that you can quickly begin to see patterns. Dor being a good example. You look around and you're like, look, there's Dor Loman and Dorthonian and Doriath. What is this element Dor? Because, you know, Tolkien usually puts his words together in a sensible way. You know, always has thought very carefully about how these words go together. So when you begin to see trends like that, you can notice it, and then the whole thing is very clearly given away when we get to the land of Caranthir. On page 124, the last page in the chapter, this is the sentence which I think in some ways kind of sounds silly, but again is really useful. It's sort of a really good place to start, you know, if you're looking for the kind of linguistic key, because often, not always, but often Tolkien will provide the English translation of the names that you can work with. So if you go to page 124, the end of the second to last paragraph in the chapter, see, after the semicolon there, but all the great land between Gelion and the mountains, between Rerir and the river Askar, was called by the Noldor Thargelion, which signifies the land beyond Gelion, or Dor Caranthir, the land of Caranthir. So, I mean, those are two names which are really easy to translate, right? Thargelion. Okay, so the place on the other side of the river Gelion is called Thargelion. So we can work out what Thar means. It means, you know, over there, on the other side of. Dor Caranthir, the land of Caranthir. Okay, that's pretty simple. That's pretty easy, right? And then you look at, but then, of course, you can go backwards and apply that around, and you can see what all of these other ones mean. I would recommend to you the index in the Houghton Mifflin trade paperback is excellent. Not only because not only does it give the page numbers where the names and stuff appear, but it also very often gives a translation of it. So if you look, just go to the DOR entry in the index, which is on page 324, and you can see it gives the translation of most of these names. Dorthonian is the land of pines. Doriath, there it is, the land of the fence. Doriath. Dordinan, the silent land. Dor Daedaloth, land of the shadow of horror. There it all is. Dor Caranthir. And also, if you keep going a little bit more to the appendix, Elements in Quenya in Sindarin Names, this will actually give you more precisely, in a much more sort of linguistic form, what this is. So you can see on page 357, the element Dor is listed as land, i.e. dry land as opposed to sea, and then gives examples of where you can see this, including, of course, Gondor and Mordor, as we were talking about before, Eriador also. So you can also most of the times that you find a name of anything, of a person or a place, you can pretty much go to this and look up the different parts of it and the different elements, and be able to piece together what that name means. Again, this is Tolkien loved this stuff, and Tolkien thought about this a lot, obviously. So that's always a fun thing to do. Jack, you had a question about elven population.
Mm-hmm. Well, in getting through this chapter, I spent a lot of time looking at the map. And looking at the map, you can see it's a pretty big landmass by any measure. And when I was thinking about this, I thought back to the previous chapter when Thingol was concerned about all these elven immigrants, all these princes of the West coming over and possibly, you know, displacing his people. And so it made me think about, you know, how many elves are there? And do we ever get an idea of that? Or was he just being reactionary?
We don't get any clear sense of the actual population, though if anything, you know, it doesn't seem like it's very huge. I mean, sometimes when we see elven armies in the field, it seems like there are quite a lot. Though even there, the one time that I can remember when an actual number is used, and this is skipping forward a little bit, this is in the near Nithor Noidiad, in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. So as to avoid spoilers as much as possible, one army emerges which is described as being 10,000 strong. And it's described like it's a massive army of 10,000 people. So that's, you know, that's the whole, you know, this one, you know, elven host, which is 10,000. So I think, you know, the armies are being numbered in thousands, not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. The population as a whole can't be that high. We know they don't live in general. They don't learn. They don't live in mega cities. You know, there are fortresses that they have, and they do. I mean, they do build cities, but it's not like you know, it's not like we have like the, you know, massive elven metropolises and stuff. And the land, a lot of the actual land. I mean, when Jack, as you allude to, you know, Thingol's concerns about displacement, we're clearly not talking about displacement in the sense of we're going to come and we're going to take all the land, kick you out of the land that you used to live on, and we're going to take that land and live for ourselves. There is clearly a lot of open land in Beleriand. Even in this chapter description, we get these, you know, these references to these wide swaths of land. When we travel around in them in some of the stories, they're not going to see a settlement for, you know, hundreds of miles at a time. And, you know, we're told even at the end, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, at the end just of the previous chapter, yeah, but the Sindar had the fairer voices and were more skilled in music, and they loved the woods and riversides, but some of the Grey Elves still wandered far and wide without settled abode, and they sang as they went. And so there's always this sense of them wandering far and wide without settled abode, that is in what seems to be fairly empty country. Beleriand is obviously not densely settled in any sense of that word or of that concept. So I think when Thingol was talking about, you know, the Noldor coming and taking over, he was concerned about, it seems to be more of an authority question, because there's no question that the Noldor are great. I mean, we're told the difference is so striking between the Sindar, you know, who are Moraquendi, and the Noldor who are Caliquendi, coming over from the Blessed Realm. And we know that in places where the Noldor and Sindar are living together, like in Nevrost, for instance, they all take Turgon as their lord. So what we do have is a kind of political takeover of the majority of Beleriand. Again, it's not like we're going to kick the Grey Elves out and they had cities and we're going to, you know, destroy their cities and we're going to take over those plots and things. I mean, no, that doesn't really happen. They do seem to be quite peaceably integrated in many places, but again, I think that, the displacement is a kind of political displacement. And I think he is a little touchy about that. You know, Thingol knows that he is not, he's not the biggest fish in the pond anymore. There are all these huge, huge fish that have just come into his little pond. Now you'll notice that the Noldor still all of the people who are referred to as lords among the Sindar, are still respected. You know, there's no place where we see anybody being displaced. That is, you know, we have Thingol and Doriath, of course, but even Círdan at the Havens. Remember, there's that one passage to how the Havens were accepted from the kingdom. You know, Finrod rules that whole stretch of area except for the places around the Falas, because he's not going to mess with Círdan. He's allies with Círdan, and you know, if Denethor had lived, you know, his leadership of the Green Elves would not have been questioned, even though the Green Elves are one step below even the Sindar in sort of the elvish pecking order. And the Green Elves are left to themselves. They're not, you know, they are not, don't even seem to be ruled over by the Noldor. So So I do think that, and we don't see the Noldor being really aggressive and taking stuff over. What they take over, as they said, basically, at the council, was empty land. You know, land which had been emptied, unfortunately, by the orcs, who had been in the midst of wreaking destruction on stuff.
So there's room for everybody, but maybe just not room for everybody's ego.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Who exactly is High King? Thingol's like, hey, I'm king over here, right? I am the ruler of this whole land. You guys are under me. And the Noldor's response to that is like, okay, Thingol, you keep telling yourself that, right? A king is he who can hold his own, right? You weren't ruling this place when we got here. The orcs had it completely overrun. There's definitely some ego issues. And I think that it is important to note from the beginning that there are ego issues on Thingol's side as well as on the Noldor side. It's easy to be bad-mouthing the Sons of Feanor. They've got their issues. Caranthir is clearly a jerk, but Thingol's not doing everything right here either. Of all of them, actually, Círdan seems to be the one who is actually I think, sort of passing with flying colors here. Thingol, in holding himself aloof, is, I think, really, we can see already the first level of problems that are going to be emerging there and that he's going to be a part of. But Círdan, he's doing it right. Okay, good, good. Let's talk about rivers. Matt and Jordan, you each had things you wanted to talk about the rivers. Matt, let's start with you. Matt, you had been talking about the pronouns and the way that the rivers are discussed, and I think that that's really a good observation, and it was one of the things that really struck me most in reading through this chapter this time as well. Looking at some of the examples that you pointed to, Matt, on page 120, when we're talking about the River Sirion, what Matt was drawing attention to was the personal pronouns that get used here. Second full paragraph on 120. Now the great and fair country of Beleriand lay on either side of the mighty River Sirion, renowned in song, which rose at Ithil Sirion and skirted the edge of Ard Galen ere he plunged through the pass, becoming ever fuller with the streams of the mountains. Thence he flowed south for 130 leagues, gathering the waters of many tributaries, until with a mighty flood he reached his many mouths in sandy delta in the Bay of Balar. It's not just the pronouns. The fact that Sirion is always referred to as he throughout this, as if he were a person, but also the verbs. Brandon is right. We have suddenly entered style time and without announcement. The verbs that he gathering the waters of many tributaries. And you know, he reached his many mouths. You know, we have this. It's very sort of. Very personal, very active, what the River Sirion is doing here. Mike, you wanted to chip in? It is style time, after all.
I would go further and say that the rivers are the most dynamic characters in this chapter.
I think that's perfectly fair. I mean, even just thinking about it from a geographical standpoint, Tolkien spends a lot of time talking about the rivers. The mountains are important too, but the rivers are definitely the protagonists of Beleriand. I mean, and the way in which he follows them and talks about their courses and you know, the comparison, Gelion is like twice as long, but Sirion is much wider. The Narog, which is like the third greatest river, I think that you can really see now here stylistically where I think the sort of the personality of the rivers take us is it's hard for me not to be kind of remembering Ulmo here. You know, we've talked about how the Silmarillion has this sort of alpha-centric view on things because these are elven stories of the First Age. You know, here, remember those references to Ulmo keeping in touch with people through all the rivers and the streams and how it's Ulmo who's really paying attention to what's going on in Middle-earth and he's receiving news from things. You know, there seems to be there seems to be an almost Ulmo-centric description of of Beleriand here. And I think it's hard for me not to read that as kind of a nod to Ulmo on the part of, you know, on the part of the fictional elven narrators of this, that they knew that the rivers are, you know, in a sense, their lifelines, not only in the way that we might normally think of rivers. I mean, of course, settlements, usually spring up around rivers. Rivers are always very important, when one is exploring country or one is settling a new region. Both as barriers for travel and also, as sources of water and therefore facilitating agriculture and everything else. But here, of course, in this context with the Valar and Ulmo, there is a special way in which the rivers are, work as a kind of, lifeline for the elven people. So I think that's pretty cool. And certainly the rivers are the most dynamic things that we see. And really, I think the focus of this whole narrative, so yeah, I think that is definitely pretty cool. Jordan, you had a question about the Seven Rivers?
It was one of the very few things that struck me in this chapter, was that there were seven rivers. Seven is always sort of important in the world, it seems. So there are seven rivers on the east, there are the seven Valar in the west, and soon enough there will be seven stars in the north in the sky, and I was wondering if that was significant in some way.
Well, I agree with you with the general sense that seems kind of non-coincidental, but at the same time, I'm not sure that I know exactly what to do with it either. That is what we do, you know, do we see that kind of corresponding directly or what? And I'm not really sure. I guess that's just kind of where I am with that is, yeah, that seems significant, but I don't know why. I mean, just the kind of mythic implications, you know, as Brandon is pointing out in the text here, you know, things like the Seven Hills of Rome, there are a lot of things of which there are seven. It is certainly in itself a kind of mythic number. I'm hesitant to make too much of it. That is, I'm hesitant to do, you know, a full out numerological analysis of this. Mostly because these seven rivers aren't going to be talked about much. I mean, one of them, the river Askar, is going to be important. Just because something important is going to happen near there. That is, you know, there's going to be a battle, later on, but that's kind of accidental. I mean, it's not like that shows that this river and these rivers in general are extremely significant. Anyway, I think that, yeah. So I don't want to go too far into it, but it's definitely, tantalizing at the very least. Let's see. Joe, you had a question about the Sindar and the Noldor, kind of picking up on what we were discussing before.
Like thrown in there and then they leave it. But I was wondering if it just somehow related to Turgon's success later on. I mean, the Noldor are great and everything. They're extremely powerful, but I'm not sure exactly how their numbers compare to the Sindar. But then, you know, you get them mingling, and I would assume that later on Turgon takes a great number of those people with him. And then he has a mixture, so he has, like, I guess you'd say the medium level of elves. And but I still didn't see a really strong connection to anything there. I was just wanting to ask if you could find a connection to, like, something really significant as to why that was in there, or if that really leads to something else happening in the story.
You mean with Turgon in particular?
You could say that, or anything else if there's really not anything to go on there.
No, I do think so. I mean, that's the one place that we're told where there was most of the greatest degree of the mingling of the Noldor and the Sindar there, and that they all took, that is, all of the Sindar of that region took Turgon for their lord. And I think that so the things that we can see there, conclusions that we can draw from that, I think, or conclusions suggested by that fact are, first of all, that again, we can see this kind of, it is certainly a precedent for this peaceful mingling of the two peoples. Again, Thingol sort of speaks as if he's worried that there's like this takeover, but at the same time, there's, it's clearly not hostile. When the Noldor move in, there's plenty of room for them, so the Sindar don't mind, and we can see at least in many places, depending on the attitude and personality of the Noldor in question, the Sindar are perfectly happy to live with them and join themselves to them. And certainly later on, when Turgon is going to finish building Gondolin, Gondolin is going to be, the Gondolindrim are going to be discussed almost as like a separate, you know, subset of elves, almost like a separate people. And I think this is, it's important, it's going to be important for us to remember as we're thinking about the Gondolindrim later on, that they are a mingled people. This is Sindar and Noldor mingled together. And there's not going to be a really clear distinction still made between them. But I think also the fact that this is Turgon, and Turgon is introduced here in this section as Turgon the Wise. And so I think that we can see this in his wisdom. It is certainly those who are holding themselves aloof, those who are separate. Here I would put the opposite extreme from Turgon bringing everybody together and merging the Sindar and the Noldor into one people under his guidance. That's like at the opposite end of the spectrum from Carinthir pointing and laughing at the dwarves when he meets them over there. That is, you know, he's got these other people who live near them. Now, I mean, you know, Turgon isn't exactly taking dwarves in, but but Carinthir, you know, has you know, he finds a different group of, you know, indigenous peoples when he arrives, and what he does is distance himself from them, and he mocks them, and he despises them, and you know, so I think that that's, now we see he profits from it nevertheless, but again, that's the opposite end of the spectrum. Carinthir is by far the you know, he is the harshest and the cruelest of the sons of Feanor, and also by implication the most foolish to build the kind of community that Turgon is building. Is obviously, it's one of the things that makes him wise, or it's rather, it's one of the, since he is wise, that's what he's doing. This is a good idea. This is how things are supposed to be working. And Carinthir is not doing anybody any favors, himself included. It would have been really interesting to see, had either somebody else lived in Dor Carinthir, or had Carinthir been a different kind of guy, what might have happened there. We know later on that it is possible to have partnership and community with the elves. You know, the interesting thing, Carinthir's nephew, Celebrimbor, is going to be the one who's going to make that happen. Celebrimbor and also Galadriel and Celeborn are going to have that really good relationship with Durin's folk over in Casa Doom, from Eregion and also from Lorien. So we know that that kind of partnership between elves and dwarves is possible. And so, you know, we get this kind of semi-glimpse of, like, that could have happened here. And how might things have been different had that happened? We know the dwarves are generally the allies of the elves. Most of the time, they're going to be working with the elves, with a major exception later on. But yet, they're never going to be really fully integrated. They're never really partners. They're not part of the Leaguer, for instance. And again, I think that that's sort of a lost opportunity. So it's interesting, of course, geographically, they're opposite to each other. Turgon over on the coast in the west, and Carinthir in the far east. But I think we can really see in this kind of moral spectrum how different they are, too. Dave, go ahead.
So I wonder if another interesting thing about this chapter is we see the Mandos' curse and the oath of Feanor and his kids in action. Because you just mentioned, you just point out this, the sort of feeling that you sometimes get when you read through this, thinking like, if only people had worked together better and cooperated and Carinthir wasn't such a haughty guy, and Thingol wasn't so aloof and all that. And so I wonder if part of what we're seeing in this chapter is the curse of Mandos in operation, that, you know, and that this is something we've touched on multiple times. On their way out, on their way to Middle-earth, he said, you guys are cursed, but by cursed I mean you cursed yourselves, because your major problem is just going to be that you can't get along, you can't trust anyone, you can't cooperate, and you're going to end up defeating yourselves. And that's the sense we get here. We're looking at the way they're setting things up, and like, well, they're beating themselves again.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I mean, and I think that, you know, this is the consequence of the choice that they've made. They've set themselves on this path, and they're walking down this path, you know, and they're, you know, they're unfortunately going to keep at it. And certainly the Sons of Feanor are committed to it by taking, and, you know, we didn't even talk all that much, not as much as we could have, I think, of the content of the Oath of Feanor, the actual oath that they've taken. But, I mean, remember, the substance of the Oath of Feanor is a fundamentally dividing oath. They have sworn to take vengeance on anybody who tries to keep the Silmaril from them. So, I mean, we, you know, what they are saying is, you know, our desires, our claims are foremost, you know, that these things are more important than anything else. Our love for the Silmarils, our desire for the Silmarils, our right to the Silmarils, our ownership of the Silmarils outranks any kind of friendship, any kind of, benefits that we might get from community. Everybody we are willing to throw under the bus, or, you know, come down on ourselves, for the sake of the Silmarils. And that, so the Sons of Feanor are really tied to that division versus community, trend there.
Well, and what's interesting about the oath is, if I recall it correctly, they don't even leave it vague. Like, we're going to go after anyone that gets the Silmarils. They actually explicitly list pretty much all the other races, and it includes the Valar, it includes other elves. You know, they don't even leave it vague so that later if some elf happens to get a hold of a Silmaril, they can say, oh, well, we didn't mean you, we just meant the evil guys, Morgoth. No, they go out of their way to say, if any other elf gets a hold of a Silmaril, he's in trouble. If somehow a Valar gets a hold of it, I guess we'll work on that if we come to it. But they go out of their way to explicitly list sort of all the various races and peoples that they can imagine point? They don't want it to be vague. They don't want to leave. They want to make sure they have no escape clauses.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's really a loophole-free oath. I mean, it's exactly. No, that's true. And I think that, again, thinking about how the curse, you know, thinking about that in the context of how the Curse of Mandos works, you know, we could say, well, the Curse of Mandos is just the carrying out of the decisions that they made in leaving Valinor, you know, which is going to then manifest itself in the abandonment of Fingolfin and the burning of the ships. Now, at the same time, you can go back one step further and say, well, yeah, but the decisions that they made to leave Valinor, this is already contained in the oath that Feanor has sworn. And then that, but that itself also is merely, the outflowing of the decisions he'd already been making and the path that Feanor was already walking when he was, you know, denying the sight of the Silmarils to other people and that he was forgetting that the light in them was not his own. All of this sort of comes back to being sort of expressions of the same thing. The oath, of course, is significant because they are tied to it. It actually does have, compulsion powers. And it's interesting. It's, you know, in a sense, the Oath of Feanor binds them in ways that the Curse of Mandos doesn't bind them in the same way. To some extent, the Curse of Mandos seems to be more of a prediction than an actual compulsion. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about this chapter is we're sort of in the lull, the calm before the storm. And what is it, like 500 years or something like that? It's a long period of time where not a lot is really talked about. And the Oath of Feanor sort of takes a back seat. Nobody really seems to be thinking about going after the Silmarils for quite a long time.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I actually think it's kind of interesting the way that lull is reflected in these chapters. that is after the last chapter, which was so eventful, we get this chapter in which, needless to say, not all that much happens, not very action-filled. And then there's going to be several more, which are just sort of setting the stage, and it's not until chapter 18 that events are going to start moving forward again. And yeah, I think this is the beginning of the longest period of peace, or nearly peace, that we're going to see. And I do think the Oath of Feanor is kind of interesting here. We have this is a very different strategy from Feanor's himself. Again, to return to that line that I was quoting earlier about, Feanor knew nothing of the defense that, that Morgoth had already made for himself in so short a time at Angband. But even if he had known, he would have attacked it single-handedly anyway. You can't imagine Feanor being like, yeah, let's besiege Morgoth for 500 years. Let's just like hang out here and we'll keep him in place and that'll be good. But clearly the sons of Feanor are fine with this as a means of fulfilling the vow. I mean, hey, we know where the Silmarils are. They're right over there. But they're not attacking. And in part, this is because Maedhros is obviously wiser than his dad was. And I think that, certainly if willingness to work together and form community instead of division is a sign of wisdom in Turgon, certainly Maedhros is wiser than Feanor in this way, because of course it's Maedhros who not only facilitates the community, the newfound community, the regained community between the people of Feanor and the people of Fingolfin and Finarfin, but he abdicates. He is the rightful heir, and this is only a comparatively small deal is made of this. When he defers to Fingolfin and says, "No, you are the rightful heir," we're told that not all of the sons of Feanor agree, and it's clearly not true. He is obviously the rightful heir. He is the eldest son of the eldest son of Finwë. And it's not like the oldest living male relative, whatever. I mean, we will see after this, it will go down in sons. When Fingolfin dies, we don't just look around for the next oldest guy necessarily. So, I think that, it's a pretty remarkable thing. Maedhros, I think, really deserves a lot of credit. And to me, the number one thing, the most admirable thing that Maedhros does ever is that, not abdication, but that deferring to Fingolfin. That's the straight up. That's, I think, the best, the clearest illustration of that. Jason, you're pointing out exactly what I was thinking while I was talking to Turgon. Does succeed Fingon. It doesn't go straight from Fingon to Gil-galad, who is Fingon's son. So there is further precedent there. But again, then why after Turgon does it go to Gil-galad? There are still others. There are still others available. I mean, if we're going to next oldest, if we're going to sort of next most senior, I mean, why not Maedhros when Fingon dies? Maedhros is still alive, when both Fingolfin and Fingon are dead. Of course, I mean, he's a son of Feanor, and there's still, although that those wounds are healed, that still might be sort of a big stretch. But anyway, I mean, I think it's the line of succession of the Noldor kings, I think, is not necessarily perfectly clear. But what is really clearly emphasized is that Maedhros was clearly the presumptive heir of the rulership of the Noldor, and that his action in giving it up to Fingolfin was an act of self-sacrifice and of, an act of dispossession, not only of him, but of all of his brothers and their people. So I think that's pretty clear. Good. Let's see. Elizabeth, you had a Treebeard question. I'm delighted that you're bringing this up.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. One of the redeeming qualities of this chapter for me is it gives context to one of my very favorite Treebeard moments, when he's sort of chanting to Merry and Pippin about his, I guess, past in Valyrian, where he's, I don't know, wandering in the woods of Osirian and in Dorthonion, and it's just a great moment. And this chapter in the Silmarillion really kind of lays all of that out, I guess, geographically, and gives us the context for that. And I like to think of Treebeard kind of wandering around in First Age, you know, Middle Earth or Beleriand, and yet we never get any mention of him ever in any of the Silmarillion.
Yeah, I agree. We will actually see a glimpse of him, not by name, but I think that we can be pretty confident that he is going to be there. We will briefly meet Ents later on, and again, I think there's a 0% chance that Treebeard himself isn't there. But yes, we do get this chapter. Here's another usefulness of this chapter. It helps you to understand Treebeard's In the Willowmeads song. This is in the Treebeard chapter, chapter 4, I believe, of book 3, in the Two Towers. So yes, you get lots of our favorite places here. I wandered in summer in the elm woods of Osirian. Ah, the light and the music in the summer by the seven rivers of Osir. You've got Neldoreth. You've got to the pine trees upon the highland of Dorthonion. I climbed in the winter. And he's giving the names in different languages too. Ah, the wind and the whiteness and the black branches of winter upon Orad Nathon. When he starts, and I walk in Ambarona, in Taura Morna, in Aldalome, in my own land, the country of Fangorn. Treebeard at some moments he's like a walking linguistic indulgence, as he is always giving things in multiple versions of multiple languages of names and things. We can see, and this is, you know, again, another thing that I would just come back to about the function of this chapter and the point of this chapter, certainly from Tolkien's perspective. Treebeard's, that glimpse of Treebeard wandering through the land, and his Treebeard's just pleasure in the countryside, you know, wandering up and down, and then all of the different regions of Beleriand. You know, you've got the lowlands by the rivers, and you've got the highlands of Dorthonion, and oh, the beech forests, and oh, the elms, and the pine trees, and you know, all of these different regions, and Treebeard's just, and the different pleasures in each. You know, we're sort of going through the seasons, and the different beauties and the different pleasures of each season in all of these different regions. And basically that seems to me that the spirit of Treebeard's song there, this, you know, his pleasure in remembering, the beauty of Beleriand, is, I think, one of the things that we can hear if we listen in Tolkien's descriptions here as well. He really loves these places, and you get these moments where he, often you get these moments where he will kind of linger and describe things and give the names of these places, and I think you can really see the pleasure that he took in the land and the geography. This is why he spent time writing stuff like this. This is why he spent all this time drawing maps, because he really did seem to love it. Okay, let's see. One or two other points. Let's see. John, whose microphone isn't working tonight, had a question about the translation of Angband. It's described, it is called, in what sounds like the English translation of it, Angband, the Hells of Iron. But John rightly points out that the literal translation of that name is Iron Prison. And that's true. And I think there, we can see, one thing that we can see there is a kind of caution. Hey, John, I can hear you. Your microphone's working again. Great. Yeah.
Good. All right. I had a little PC troubles tonight working on new
okay.
PC. All right. So, first point, yes. First point I would like to address. I didn't hear your last bit, but I'll move on to my comment about Angband. Now, we all know that Angband, the translation Tolkien gives us, is the Hells of Iron. It reminds me very much of the Blind Guardian song, Time Stands Still at the Iron Hill, which
right.
You all know. But if we study the Sindarin Index, we know that Eng means iron, and Band means prison. So that the Sindarin translation is Iron Prison, rather than Hells of Iron. It's not a huge difference, but we do see, well, It's obviously there. So I was wondering, I don't think it's a mistake on Christopher Tolkien's part. And I don't think, J.R.R. Tolkien himself intended there to be, some discrepancy. There has to be some reason, some mode behind it. I know in earlier drafts in the Book of Lost Tales, Angband was called Angamandi. Yes. And, of course, we see it changing over time and, the whole principle. Also, I wanted to cover backwards. When you asked me about Dor, in terms of Dor Loman, Doriath, I thought it might mean kingdom. As in, we see it also in Gondor, Arnor, and, I also noticed similarities. I'm sorry if I'm rambling on like last time, but considering even Aang, as in like Angmar,
Angmar, Angris.
At times, we have some of the definitions which we are given.
Yep.
And yet, they don't always hold necessarily exactly true. Maybe due to poetic license. Anyway, it's my treatise on Sindarin names. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, you mentioned poetic license, and that's exactly what I would say. There are certainly times, both in the English translations and in the Sindarin names themselves, when he's not just being, literal, basically, when he's also being metaphorical. And I think it's one important caution to remember that we do sometimes get, a kind of metaphorical renderings of the Sindarin words. So yes, he calls Angband the Hells of Iron. Well, yes, it means iron prison. But of course, one of the things that is going to be the primary, its function as a prison is going to be one of the main things that we're going to see. There's almost never, going to be an actual assault. There's never going to be a serious assault upon Angband during this whole time. So its use as a fortress of defense almost never comes up. What it is primarily going to be is a prison. This is where, if you're captured, you're going to be hauled into Angband, and you're going to be kept there and usually made to work as a slave and tortured. So that is like the elvish hell. I am tempted to bring it up, and I'm going to give in to temptation, though it may muddy the water somewhat. In the Book of Lost Tales, in the original versions of the Silmarillion stuff, from early on, one of the constructions that Tolkien had for basically the afterlife stuff, the way the Halls of Mandos worked and everything else, in one place he suggests that Angband itself, that is, that Morgoth's realm, serves as in fact a kind of hell, in the sense of, like, that's where the spirits of bad people go after they die. So in that case, it is... In origin, in one version, I'm giving lots of qualifications for it, because this was, I think, not a very fully fleshed out idea of Tolkien's, and he abandoned it pretty soon after that. But it is clear that at least one point it was in his mind that the realm of Morgoth and the fortress of Morgoth would actually be hell itself, or at least a version of hell, And there, of course, we can see the connection between hell and prison as well. Not only just sort of hell as a metaphor for prison, and it's certainly the kind of prison that people are put in there. But another important thing to remember, and this is, I think, a crucial fun thing about Angband. One of the few fun things about Angband, actually. But one of the fun things about Angband is that, of course, it is a prison. But ironically, this is a prison for Morgoth. It's not a prison. It's not only a prison for other people. It's a prison for Morgoth himself. Just as hell, of course, is not the palace of Satan where human souls are kept. It is Satan's prison. Where he is imprisoned. Milton is pretty right about that, handles that part pretty well. But anyway, this is, it's Morgoth himself who's in prison. He's only ever going to once get out on furlough, and he's not going to enjoy it. Jordan's main elf is going to see to that. But anyway, so it is, you know, his own hell. And we will see this, you know, coming back too, just as the Iron Crown that he has made for himself, as King of the Universe, is going to be beaten into an iron collar for his neck. So his own fortress, his own castle, is going to be, you know, is essentially his own prison as well. So, oops, I see in the text, Dave is mad at me. That's what you were going to say, right? So I stole your comment. Sorry, Dave. I would like to give full credit to Dave Kale, who was going to say, was it the prison bit that you were going to say, Dave?
Yes, that is correct. I thought I was going to be clever and jump in and say, you know, what's interesting you say about it being a prison, because it seems like the main prisoner there is Morgoth.
Yeah. Yeah, very good, very good. Well, see, I should let you jump in more quickly. Oh, well. But anyway, full credit for...
It's all right, I steal other people's points, as Laura points out. I am also a point thief.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Let's see, Mike, you wanted to talk about ash and slag?
Yes. When I read that, I circled that, and I was like, I've seen that
yes.
before. And I would invite others to do what I did, which is I went to Google Books and did a quick search of Return of the King, and I searched for ash and slag or ash or slag, and I'll just say that Tolkien delivers on that theme masterfully in Return of the King, and it's so interesting to read about ash and slag coming through in terms of characters, locations, important battles. That theme, it's a one-off in this chapter where Thangarandrib is described as being made of ash and slag, but that's blown, that's expanded so amazingly in Return of the King. The most interesting one for me that I had totally blanked on was Denethor and his relationship to the, at least the ash part of that phrase. So there are too many points to go into here, but offline I would invite anyone who's interested in doing that to just pull it up and read through some of the ash or ash and slag connections in that final part of the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I was kind of thinking through. Yes, you got Denethor and his house collapsing into ashes, and you've got Gollum's exclamation right next to the cracks of doom: ashes. And he's talking about what you will find in Mordor: ashes and dust. Chris, you wanted to add to this?
Well, I don't know how much it adds to anything, but there's a modern usage of that. I work for a utility company, and one of our old coal firing power plants, the lowest rung of the entry level position is an ash and slag person, and that's what they do, is they shovel the ash and slag out of the furnaces after it's burnt. So small. I thought that was interesting. I heard that term, and that's what our company used to have when we had that plant.
Well, there you go. The real life, and actually, you know, connecting ash and slag in that sense to like that kind of an industrial context would be exactly perfect. You know, that's one of the ways in which you can see just as you know, Sauron in Mordor, and as we see Morgoth up there in Angband, you know, like ash and slag are two of the primary side products of what they do. You know, they put this terrible stuff out. So yes, you know, it's exactly like very like industrial.
And,
go ahead.
And actually, seriously, I went through that facility a couple times, and you couldn't envision a better setting for Mordor. It was old, it was dirty, and you know, you've got stuff burning, so it's the whole place black. So a perfect metaphor for Mordor or Angband, also.
Yeah. No, I think that's really cool, and that's exactly the kind of thing that he was thinking of. You know, it's one of the things that he hated most about industrialization. One thing that vaguely on the ash and slag topic, I want to go to sort of read one last passage, which I think is really cool, on page 118. That is the end of the second full paragraph in the chapter. it's in the description of Ardgallen, the fields that lie between, you know, the plain that lies between Angband and Dorthonion. Before the gates of Angband, filth and desolation spread southward for many miles over the wide plain of Ardgallen. But after the coming of the sun, rich grass arose there, and while Angband was besieged and its gates shut, there were green things, even among the pits and broken rocks before the doors of hell. I love that last sentence. While Angband was besieged and its gates shut, there were green things even among the pits and broken rocks before the doors of hell. And, you know, what you can see here, you have firstly this impulse towards desolation. You know, evil creatures, really evil creatures, are always surrounded by desolation in Tolkien, whether it's Smaug in The Hobbit or Sauron in Mordor, or Morgoth up here in Angband. You know, you always get this this filth and desolation spreading out from them. But what we get here is the sun arising. Just as, you know, in the desolation of Smaug, we get already the hints of a returning to life towards the end. And then, of course, this is the thing, of course, that Frodo picks up on when he's talking to Glowin in, you know, just before the Council of Elrond. Like, oh, you know, Bilbo would have been so delighted to hear about the changes and the desolation of Smaug. But then the sun rises. You know, here it's very sudden. The sun rises, right? And when the light strikes this stuff, grass springs up and flowers, and we find that the seeds that Yavanna has planted, the seeds of life and growth, are not destroyed. And it's such a great image of this period in the history of Beleriand, that you've got the hells of iron with little flowers growing around the gates, because Morgoth is shut in, and you can see, you know, this sense in which, because of course the sun is one of the things that is besieging him, the Leaguer, you know, in part the elves, we remember, you know, remember the discussion of Fingolfin's boast at the end of the previous chapter, you know, that the power of the elves is holding Morgoth in Leaguer. Well, no, the power of the Valar is also helping here. He is being besieged by the sun as well, and we can see, you know, the growth that's emerging from this. And Mikey, I love do you want to say aloud the thing that you just typed in the main box there? Because I think it's really great.
Sure. Well, gardener that I am, I wrote in my margin volcanic soil, because I was thinking of the same description around Mount Doom and sort of illustrating one of the points we've been making, which is you can try and do evil, but it'll all work out for good in the end. And even if you create a huge volcano and cover the countryside with volcanic ash, ultimately that will create beautiful, you know, organic volcanic soil, and grass and flowers and trees will go there, and it'll be the most fertile part of the continent. So no matter how hard you try, it's all going to work out.
Yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, and I think that we can see, you know, the seeds of that are already sown, and it's such a taunting of Morgoth, you know, Mr. Like, I am king of the universe here in my bunker sub basement. And you know, there will, you know, there are daisies springing up at his gates as soon as the sun rises. Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's just, you know, in your face, Morgoth. Well, good. I think, does anyone have anything else that they would like to add here tonight? I think we've hit on all the things that I had wanted to hit on. All right. Great. Good. Well, again, thanks for joining me as usual. We will return to a slightly more eventful chapter next time in the Noldor and Beleriand. Certainly a few more things will happen, get a little more dialogue than in this chapter. And we'll come back especially to the founding of Gondolin, and the visions of Olmo, which we kind of passed over last time, but I think they'll be sort of more compellingly relevant even next week. So, all right, great. Well, thanks a lot, and I'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.